The RPG After Years is part of the We Can Make This Work Probably Network. Find out more at probablywork.com.
Welcome to the RPG After Years, your weekly show covering all things RPGs from the past, present, and future. I'm Scott, and with me today is a man who no longer needs an introduction, and my fiancé.
It's me, Corey.
Yeah, glad to have you. This is episode 32. Today we are beginning our review of an RPG that needs no introduction. It's Persona 5. Can we make a difference? If we don't break out of here, wake up, get up, get up there. Raise your voice, I guess, like yours. Feed a runner a fire. Why does nobody want to? Just imagine you're out there, swallowing lights in a maker. Can't move fast when I break it. If you hold on, life won't change. And in our case, we will be reviewing Persona 5 Royal, the re-release of the game. We have never actually played the original version. I think I watched a friend play the first couple hours of it once upon a time.
Yep, back in the day.
Yep. But since it's a review, we won't be doing any catch-up or anything like that. Today, we will be covering the development history and the first part of the game's story. So in part two of the review, we'll finish off the story. Hopefully, we'll see. It's a long-ass story. Yeah. And in part three, we'll talk about the gameplay, the new Royal content, and our final ratings. But before that, let's get on to the save state of the podcast. All right, guys, the RPG After Years, as all of you hopefully know, has a pretty bonkin' Patreon for you all. Corey, as a patron, I'm going to let you talk about it.
Good. I see what you did there.
For those that don't know, Ryuji tries to get bonkin' going, the phrase, at some point during the game.
Stop trying to make bonkin' happen. It's not going to happen.
I'm going to start using it in real life.
Oh, God. All right, so about this Patreon. Let me tell you, since I am a patron, this is like a real customer review for you. But I get early episode access, so I can listen to the episodes a few days early. I also don't have to listen to these guys talk about Anchor or anything else because my episodes are ad-free. I get to listen to the aftercast where these guys will occasionally get together and just kind of shoot the shit about some random topic, and they'll usually be a little less politically correct, we should say. You get some true opinions. You'll get extra reviews. A lot of them are me and Scott doing Nintendo game reviews. You get the RPG Club nominations and voting, which is pretty cool. Last one was Wild Arms, and there will be another one coming up after that, and there's plenty more. So just go throw these guys a couple dollars at patreon.com/RPG After Years.
Yep. And I think the next round of nominations and voting is going to happen at the beginning of October. So it's coming up.
Ooh.
And speaking of the aftercast, we are on Twitch right now, and we'll be streaming the aftercast tomorrow morning. So our Twitch channel is at twitch.tv/RPG After Years. Usually we stream the main episode Sunday at 9 a.m. But we decided to use that slot for the aftercast this week, since it was just me and Corey doing the Persona 5 review. Rich and Jay have played Persona 5, the first little bit of it, but we knew we would never actually get there if we tried to wait on them or something like that.
But not the 482 hours worth.
So those of you on Twitch, you can be a part of the show. We'll interact with the chat live on the episode. So look forward to that, and we enjoy hanging out. And also, speaking of the RPG Club, currently we are playing Wild Arms, as Corey said. We're about to enter the second week of this segment. The next session will take place on September 20th, so you have until then to finish the Pandemonium dungeon in Wild Arms, which I assume it's a dungeon. I haven't actually gotten there yet myself. This this preparation for this review has been killing me. One more announcement. Our merch store is live now. We've got mugs, t-shirts, all kinds of like different types of tops and, you know, sweaters and different apparel. And then we've got like random items like coasters and magnets and stuff like that. I just got a huge shipment myself this week.
You're excited about that mug.
Mugs. Speaking mug. Of which, here is a sample. This is our mug for anybody that's watching live or watching this live later. It's pretty cool. It's just got our album art on it. And, you know, I think our album art is pretty legit. So,
pretty banging.
And it's pretty bonking.
It's bonking.
And then I think, Corey, you're wearing some merch too.
I am. I've got my super soft black V-neck with the white logo. Hey, this shirt is super soft.
It looks good on you. I haven't actually seen you wear that one yet. So, this is new for me too. So if you're looking for that, just go to Redbubble and search RPG After Years. We've got about 5 different designs, variations of the logo and album art. We hope you check it out. It's you can rep your favorite podcast. I know you guys love us that much. And as we said, there's no news since this is a review. And with all that out of the way, we're going to take a quick break before we move on to the news. Not the news, the review. Let's try it again.
Hi, this is Troidal Power, the host of Troidal Power Presents the Power Playthroughs podcast, the podcast where I, your host, Troidal Power, play through games in a powerful way. And right now on Troidal Power Presents the Power Playthroughs podcast with Troidal Power, I, your host, Troidal Power, am playing through Golden Sun. You should come listen to me play Golden Sun on Troidal Power Presents the Power Playthroughs podcast with Troidal Power. Find it and a lot of other weird stuff at probablywork.com.
Alrighty, let's get back to the review. It's the 2016 PS3 and PS4 legend, Persona 5. Sure we got the clue, how bad is we go? Don't you know, no more art. And as you look to the horizon, not to cloud, but then stormy weather's go to cold. Seems like it great, but out of nowhere, all the rest, you is not what to foretold. You never see it coming. You say that my mind is too fast for right. You're dying. But the diamond said you, you're not the prize. And again, just a quick disclaimer. We only played the Royal version, so we can't really comment on like any of the major or more intricate differences between the two games. I did like research it a little bit, and it's kind of surprising how much they changed, but don't hate us if we get something wrong. So Persona 5, the original, came out in Japan on September 15th, 2016, which was 4 years, 0 months, and 5 days ago. So time has sure flown. Worldwide, it came out on April 4th, 2017, which was 1,266 days ago, or 3 years, 5 months, and 16 days. So, a little bit of time now between the original and where we are now.
Just a little bit. And then the Royal Edition, released in Japan on October 31st, 2019, which was just a mere 326 days ago, or 10 months, 20 days. And then it was released worldwide March 31st of this year, which was only 147 days ago, which in quarantine life feels like 6 years.
For real. I think what we were already in quarantine at that point. So,
yeah, we were 2 weeks into
it. I remember you were pretty excited about it because we had this pre-ordered and you had been talking about wanting to play it forever.
I was waiting forever.
I kept telling you, honey, the royal version is right around the corner. It's going to be so much better if we just wait. Like, we wouldn't have gotten any of that story about Maruki or Kasumi or any of that, that whole third semester.
It was worth the wait.
Okay. So we did try talking about what were like the top headlines during these reviews at that time. But every time I've tried to do it, the articles were like just bad news, distracting or depressing stuff about like Trump or COVID or like political shit. And it's very hard to go back that far and find stuff from like pop culture and shit. So we're dropping that segment for now. I even tried looking at what were the Twitter hashtags trending at that on that day. And there is an archive out there, but that doesn't mean I know what they were talking about.
I don't even want to know what the news was on March 31st of year.
No, you don't. But we are still doing what was at the top of the music charts at the time. And we do go by the US and UK release dates. So when the original came out, number one was Shape of You by Ed Sheeran.
Isn't the best place to find a lover, so the bar is where I go. Me and my friends at the table doing shots, tripping fast, and then we talk slow.
I'm a casual Ed Sheeran fan, and I don't mind this song too much.
Oh, I like it.
It's got like a nice little catch to it.
It's bonking.
Everything's bonking today. Trying to wait for the chorus to roll around. Maybe I should start editing these before.
Pick a better starting point.
And then the song was also the number one in the UK at the time. So. Oh, yeah, there we go. I remember this song.
Yeah.
All right. And then when Royal came out in the U.S., the number one song was The Box by Roddy Ricch, which I believe has been played on this show before.
Isn't that the guy from Big and Rich?
I don't know. It doesn't sound like him. Wait, isn't there like a black guy that sings with him a lot?
I have no
doesn't
idea.
Doesn't sound like him, though.
So, got a cash app. Told him wipe it. No, say slash slash. I won't never sell my soul.
Not my thing at all. I remember when we played it on the show before, I hadn't listened to it yet, and he definitely drops the N-word. So,
oh yeah, that's
I
right.
I made sure to find the clean version this time. And then in the UK was Roses by Saint John.
Rose, I walked in the corner with the demon daughter. Never sold a bag, but looking like Pablo in the fold. This gonna make him feel your way.
That is some great getting high music.
What is this?
Nothing, apparently. I'm sure there's some listeners out there that like this thing, but not for us.
Back in my day, we had real music like Britney Spears.
Oh, God. Well, we also do what was number one at the movies, so why don't you do that for us, Corey?
All right. So when the original was released, the US and the UK actually had the same box office number one, a movie called The Boss Baby. Gotta admit, I have no idea what
that
is. It
was like an animated movie where like the baby became like a CEO of a company or something somehow. I'm surprised it did that well because I didn't hear anything else about it.
Well, it made it to number one somehow. All right. So when Royal was released, in the US, our box office was Onward, which we did watch. Isn't that the one with Chris Pratt and Tom Holland?
That was the Pixar
movie
that was released publicly instead of the theaters because of the quarantine.
Yeah, that was a cute little movie. I like that one. Then in the UK, they actually didn't report this because COVID had shut everything down. The last one that was reported before COVID shut down the UK was The Invisible Man.
Do you know what that is? I have no idea either. We actually got
interesting times considering they wouldn't even. Well, hell, theaters were probably fucking closed.
Yeah. We got Jay in the chat. Hey, Jay. He says he's in love with the shape of Corey, I think, referencing Ed Sheeran. And he said, it's Britney, bitch.
That's right.
And he says the Boss Baby is great and the Invisible Man is real good. So got some strong recommendations from our favorite co-host here. All right. Do we want to jump into the history? We have a lot of info on the development of this game. Like, it took me forever to get all this down, but it was all interesting. So we're going to try to get through this.
Buckle up, bitches, because here we go. All right. So let's get into this. Let's get in the weeds. All right. So Persona 5 is a role-playing video game developed by Atlus. It is the sixth installment in the Persona series, which is a part of the larger Megami Tensei franchise. It was released for the PS3 and PS4. It takes place in modern-day Tokyo and follows a high school student going by the pseudonym Joker, who transfers to a new school after being falsely accused of assault and put on probation. Over the course of the school year, he and the other students awaken to a special power, becoming a group of secret vigilantes known as the Phantom Thieves of Hearts.
Yep. I didn't catch this when I was writing it down, but Persona 5 is the sixth installment? What's going on with that?
You wrote it, not me.
Joker is a silent protagonist, and you get to name him, so he actually doesn't have a canon, like, real name, although apparently they call him Ren in the anime. So,
yeah, Ren.
So if you catch us getting confused saying, like, Persona 5, the protagonist or whatever, we're just calling him Joker the whole time.
Yeah.
Okay, so Persona 5 was developed by P Studio, an internal development studio within Atlus, led by game director and producer Katsuri Hashino. Along with Hashino, returning staff from earlier Persona games included character designer Shigenori Sojima and music composer Shoji Meguro. Preparatory work began during the development of Persona 5, with full development beginning after the release. Oh, that should say Persona 4. With full development beginning after the release of Catherine in 2011.
Catherine
is a game that Corey and I both love quite a lot. So very similar art styles, too. Hashino called Catherine a test run for Persona 5. First announced in 2013, Persona 5 was delayed from its original late 2014 release date due to the game not being fully finished. Development lasted 5 years. The general development was a challenge for the team due to the more powerful hardware, as well as rendering the game in HD. So apparently they had a hard time moving on to, like, newer hardware.
Yeah. While the final game retained the turn-based battle system from earlier entries, an early draft plan used an action-based system incorporating real-time elements foreign to the series. The idea was ultimately scrapped, however, but real-time command elements were introduced into the battle system, and that allowed the gameplay to evolve without extensive changes to, like, the core system. A major new addition was the inclusions of unique dungeons and locked layouts, as opposed to the dominant randomly generated dungeons from previous Persona games. The negotiation system was also brought back after having been absent from Persona 3 and 4. They felt that the mechanic matched the game's theme well. Some of the segments also take control away from the player, other than limited dialogue choices. This was chosen as it reflected the controlled environment of Japanese high schoolers.
I think it was chosen because it made it easier to make the scenes.
Probably.
I thought that was very interesting. I didn't know that the past Persona games all had randomly generated dungeons. Like that. I'm glad that they went that way. By the way, did you know that Mementos is randomly generated, though? The layout changes every time you go in, apparently.
Yeah, I did know that, yeah.
Very interesting. So, while Catherine used the third-party Gamebryo game engine, Persona 5 used a specifically created engine. Hashino believed using their own engine would allow them to bring their ideas to life much easier, although it did contribute to the game's long delay. The event scene software was also developed internally by Atlus, with an estimated 1,160 being featured in the final game. Wow. The characters were originally rendered realistically, like in Catherine, but the team felt that it was, quote, wrong for the Persona series. They went through some trial and error before finding a style that satisfied them, doing something similar for the interface and menu design.
And they freaking knocked
That's
it out of
the park.
Probably
the best thing about the game is the UI.
It's
but
amazing.
I was kind of confused by this because as far as, like, the art style, I think it's very similar to Catherine, so I don't get why they said...
It's very similar, so it's just like a more polished version.
Game people need to stop making their own engines. It makes the games take like years longer.
The original story concept was written by Hoshino, and the concept that it would center on a journey of self-discovery for the main characters as they embarked on a backpacking trip across the world. However, in the wake of the 2011 Tohoku earthquake and tsunami, Hoshino decided to refocus on Japan. He noted that the Japanese government's actions in response to the fallout, along with the Japanese citizens' reactions to the government's response, served as a partial influence on the game's themes. With that in mind, Hoshino decided it should take place solely in Japan, with the journey aspect being moved to the game's palace dungeons. Ultimately, the story's central concepts were inspired by equivalent social changes he saw in modern society, particularly in Japan. Hoshino also described the central theme of the game as being about freedom and how the characters attain it. He wanted to make the game more thematically approachable for newcomers to the series and to be an emotional experience that left its audience with a strong sense of catharsis and the inspiration to take on problems in their own lives.
I think they kind of nailed it, because that was like, you feel a badass being in the Phantom Thieves and like you're really changing the world.
Yeah, as soon as you go in the palace and change clothes, you're like, hell yeah, here we go. Let's change some lives.
Super interesting to me, though, that you remember that big tsunami that caused so many problems.
I mean,
to know that that is what inspired the plot and changed it so dramatically from a backpacking trip, that's really cool to me.
Yeah, and just, I mean, part of that did still kind of stay because they went to Hawaii.
That's true, which was a fun little arc.
Yeah, fun little side.
Anyway, the narrative of Persona 5 was designed like an omnibus, with the antagonist changing regularly. The game's villains and protagonists were also constructed to be parallels of each other, both groups being misfits trying to shape a world they saw as unsatisfactory or corrupted. This was done to create moral ambiguity with the Phantom Thieves and their actions. As inspiration, the development team cites the Chinese novel Water Margin, the Japanese crime movie Hakuchu no Shikaku, and the Spanish novel Lazarillo de Tormes. The team also cited one idea of how would Arsène Lupin gain favor in society. So apparently that's what Joker's main persona was named after, was some like famous criminal in the past, or maybe a fictional character. So I thought that was really interesting.
Neat. Yeah, they're trying to layer in morality. Yeah. The main characters, according to Hoshino, share a mindset that they no longer have a place where they belong in society. The events of the game give them a sense of belonging. They were described as juvenile academics, with their activities as thieves being part of the way they break from societal norms and express themselves. In contrast to previous Persona casts, the party of Persona 5 willingly embrace the unfolding unusual events in their role as masked vigilantes rather than being dragged into them. Which is true. They very happily have their freak out moment and then just embrace their personas.
They control their own fates. Like, they get their own agency, and it's really cool. The game's art director was Masayoshi Suto, who worked on the UI of earlier games. As the team considered previous Persona games to be, quote, fun, but not well marketed, they designed the UI in such a way to attract a larger, more mainstream audience. Aesthetically, the team felt as if they were picking up from where Persona 4 left off. Following the respective thematic coloring of Persona 3 and 4's blue and yellow, Persona 5 used red, which was chosen to invoke a harsh feeling. Because of this, Suto decided to use black and white colors for the game's theming, as it stood out the best against red. The main characters' personas were designed to be, quote, old-fashioned, to contrast with how sleek and modern the rest of the game was. Also, early UI designs were so, quote, aggressively animated, that it obscured what was happening in-game, so it was toned down to create more of a balance between user-friendliness and style. So apparently the UI was even more like highly stylized at one point in development.
Can you imagine it being more stylized than what it actually was?
No, because even though the UI is so awesome, there's some times where I thought like it actually did sort of distract from the actual action going on in the scene.
Did you really? Because of the characters all being high school students, character designer Shigenori Sojima found it difficult to make each character's design unique. He instead chose to express their individuality through their thief costumes. Sojima also cited Joker's design as one of the most challenging works he's ever done. Joker needed to both convey a taste of the game's overall art style and act as an avatar for the player as a silent protagonist. As the main theme revolved around crime and vigilantes triggered by Joker, Sojima needed to convey this while allowing the character to suit whatever dialogue choices the player decided.
Yep, I could see how that would be a very hard thing to do, even with any silent protagonist.
You got to make them stylish, but vague at the same time.
The game's original score was composed, performed, and produced by series sound director Shoji Meguro, with contributions from several others. It took him 3 years to produce the soundtrack. The game's vocal songs were provided by Lin Inazumi, a jazz and soul music singer. Her first performance for a video game, she described the job as very challenging due to the complex nature of the songs. Meguro also said he incorporated strong acid jazz elements into the score. I could see how that would be a difficult job. There's like, I think there were 7 vocal songs in the original. They added like 5 more for Royal. And I think she provided
there was a bunch
new songs for the anime too. So she's probably done like 20 songs for this Persona 5 series.
Just for the series.
By the way, I did see a video of her doing a live performance of Rivers in the Desert. And it was
really
pretty legit. I'll have to show you to it later.
I'm going to have to watch that. Here's some more fun trivia for you also. The main cast was originally going to be larger with the character Hifumi Togo becoming a Phantom Thief as well. But since the story was already very large, she was relegated to an optional role as part of the confidant system. Also, the name of Joker's high school, Shujin, was chosen because it was a homonym of Shujin, the Japanese word for prisoner. That's kind of cool.
That makes perfect sense.
That.
And I was surprised about the Hifumi thing.
That she was going to be like a playable character?
Because, I mean, I don't like dislike her, but I found her arc, her confidant arc, kind of boring. I just find her kind of like toast or something.
Well, it's almost like they put some of that work in there too, because she was supposed to like teach you strategy.
Oh, yeah.
So it makes sense that if she was going to teach you strategy, that she was going to like join your team and teach you strategy. Hmm. That's why I was kind of surprised that she actually didn't join the cast.
Glad she didn't. The game's long enough.
Come on, just another 20 hours.
As with previous Persona games, the English localization was handled by Atlas USA and led by Yu Namba. According to Namba, the team was allowed to choose the English voice cast for the first time. He described the localization as a massive project with the largest staff yet, as the script was estimated to be about 50% larger than Persona 4 Golden. The game's title also dropped the use of Shin Megami Tensei in English regions.
Is Persona 4 Golden, like the royal edition of 4, quote-unquote?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, and just another clarification. Neither of us have ever played any Persona game before, so we're coming into this as newbies.
But I probably, after this game, will go back and play
some. For 4 in particular is supposed to be really good. I just worry, after getting used to all the like
modern style.
Lifestyle improvements and quality of life improvements in 5, we might not like it. We'll see.
We'll see how it goes. The quality of the game's localization did draw some criticism, with Polygon describing it as, quote, aggravatingly mediocre. Another controversy was the game's treatment of LGBT topics. Kenneth Shepard noted in Pace that the only characters to exist outside of the game's thoroughly heteronormative setting are a, quote, lecherous gay couple who are treated as a joke. This scene was altered in Persona 5 Royal.
Because I
actually remember the scene it was talking about, and he was like, oh, that's the one they changed.
Yeah, apparently they like try to like drag Ryuji and like seduce him in the original version. And in this one, they like drag him away to teach him how to do drag or something like that. So,
Well, we got to convert him somehow.
So I'm really glad they changed that. And there is a lot of like romance stuff in this game. And once again, you can't do anything other than straight couples. So I get it.
Yeah.
Upon the game's worldwide release, Atlas drew public criticism when they released a set of guidelines for streaming footage. Streamers who shared footage past July 7th in game, quote, did so at the risk of being issued a content ID claim or worse, a channel strike / account suspension. Many in the industry said Atlas was very backwards and threatening with this policy. 3 weeks later, Atlas apologized for their policy and extended the limit considerably to November 19th in-game, though some critics continued to argue that even the revised streaming policy remained unfriendly to the game's fans and counterproductive to its success. You're trying to have a successful game and you don't want people to stream it?
I guess they think if they don't let you stream it, then people can't watch it, so then they have to buy it.
And I get it, because it's like a story-heavy game, but it's like, come on, join the times, you know? I remember that controversy when it happened, actually. And what is it, July 7th? That's probably only a couple palaces in.
Yeah, I think that's probably two at most. Because we
don't you start
I don't
think
in we April? Actually start in January. Yeah, you start in March or April. Yeah. So first teased as Persona 5 R, Persona 5 Royal is an enhanced version of the game exclusively for PS4. This version features an additional Phantom Thief member named Kasumi Yoshizawa, a new palace, new music, additional plots, plot lines, more social elements, a playable third semester, and support for the PS4 Pro, along with many other changes and additions.
And we're going to go into those in more detail in the last part of this review.
Yes.
Persona 5 was met with critical acclaim, with praise given to its visual presentation, art direction, gameplay, story, and music. The game was nominated for and won multiple awards, such as Best RPG at the Game Awards in 2017. GameSpot gave it a runner-up as the best game of 2017, losing out to Zelda Breath of the Wild. Man, 2017 was like a banging year.
That was the year of the game.
Horizon was that year, too.
Yep, that was an amazing year for games.
It sold more than 3 million copies worldwide by December 2019, making it the best-selling entry in the entire Megami Tensei franchise. Several other related media have also been released, including two spin-off games, Persona 5 Dancing in Starlight, which is a rhythm game, and Persona 5 Scramble, which is a Warriors game and also serves as a sequel, as well as manga and anime adaptations. The game's cast has also made appearances in other games, such as Joker appearing as a playable DLC character in the 2018 crossover fighting game Super Smash Bros. Ultimate.
And he's now my main. I'm actually pretty good with him.
I can actually kind of kick my ass with Joker a lot of times.
Jay asked if that controversy for Persona was the Aftercast episode.
Yeah, we actually did do an Aftercast where we talked about that gay, the controversy of the scene being changed around the whole Ryuji seduction by the lecherous gay couple.
Yeah, I thought I remembered y'all talking about that.
Persona 5 Scramble has actually not been brought to America yet, but I'm thinking we're going to have to at least try it when it does, because it is like an actual canon sequel to the plot.
Oh, yeah. I'll give it a whirl.
And that's it for the history. There was a lot there, but all of it was very interesting, I thought.
Well, this is a very large game with a long development. Yep.
So with that out of the way, we are going to jump into the story. Song was from Kaneshiro's Palace. It was very hard to pick it to narrow down music for these transitions, by the way.
Oh, I have no doubts, because there's a lot of bangers in there.
So like we said at the beginning of the history section, basically you follow the story of Joker. So he's in basically you begin in a casino, and he's like doing some kind of thieving project. You don't really know what he's trying to do.
Some thievery.
You don't really know what's going on. All the characters except for Joker are like silhouettes in their art that's talking. So you don't know who anybody is or anything like that. He's getting like backup support from his teammates and just trying to distract the guards and stuff.
Yeah. Cause you can still hear like Futaba talking to him. But I mean, you don't know if it's Futaba at the time.
At one point, he's being chased by the guards. He's sort of like, you are sort of like introduced to the mechanics of being stealthy and avoiding the guards and all that. And this casino looks pretty cool, by the way, design wise, but we'll get there later. Basically, the story is beginning in media res, like just in the middle of something big. He runs into a girl who we later learn is Kasumi, but she's like another thief and apparently not part of his group. She helps him out in that situation. So they introduce you to the new character in Royal right from the beginning. But ultimately, Joker ends up getting caught. So that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Sad.
So you get your introduction to the interrogation here. Basically, he's in like a holding cell, and the guards that are interrogating him are like total shitheads. They like kind of beat the shit out of him, and they even drug him, I guess, to make him say what they want. They force...
And it's these tiny girls.
Well, this is not...
Oh, wait, you're talking about in the interrogation.
Yeah, not yet.
Yeah.
So, and they even drug him, and they force him to like sign a false confession. So then a woman named Sai Najima comes in, and she's like the district prosecutor or something like that. Is that right?
Sounds about right.
So she wants to interrogate him. They give her... They say she only has like a few minutes to do it. And basically the game has this framing story where every now and then it'll jump back to the interrogation between Sai and Joker, where she's asking him about different details of how the Phantom Thieves did what they did and all that, and like the different people that were involved and stuff like that. And then so the story focuses on Joker, and it goes back in time at this point. So basically, Joker has been transferred to another school, Shujin Academy, because he assaulted a man. And it tells you pretty early on that he was actually like sexually harassing a woman in the street, and he like intervened and kind of bruised the guy or whatever. And so the guy sued him, and now Joker's considered like a delinquent.
Yeah, apparently getting sued is like one of the worst things that can happen.
Yep. He stays with Sojiro Sakura, who is like this older gentleman who runs a cafe, who apparently is a friend of Joker's parents, which I did not gather from the story. I just thought he was like...
Yeah, I didn't catch
that. I thought
he
was signed up for some kind of program to take in delinquents or something.
That's what I thought it was.
So he takes him in at Cafe LeBlanc, and he's like... He's kind of a dick to Joker at first because, you know, he doesn't trust him as a delinquent or whatever. But, yeah. So... At this point, Joker starts having dreams he wakes up in this place called the Velvet Room, which he's basically in a ring of cells. And in the middle of the cell is this character named Igor, who's like an old man at a desk. And he has these two wards who are like these little girls in police uniforms named Caroline and Justine. And one of them's like kind of nice, and the other one is like just a dick to Joker all the time. But it's like kind of in a cute way. Do you remember which one is the mean one? I can never remember.
Justine was the mean one, I believe.
So basically Igor, who is apparently in every Persona game, tells him that Joker has to go through like a rehabilitation from what he does. And these characters sort of like talk about the metaverse, which is like this parallel universe to the real world where people's cognitions become reality, like their true feelings about stuff. And you just get scenes throughout of, you know, Igor giving you progress updates on your rehabilitation.
On your rehabilitation.
And he has this awesome voice, too. It's, like, really deep. It doesn't really match his character design, which comes into play later, actually. But...
Yeah, but it's really cool at the beginning. Because everything's low and gravelly.
Your rehabilitation has not yet begun. That's not really good.
Your rehabilitation.
So that's basically the intro and the setup for the story. So we've sort of broken the plot up into like sections here, because there is like a rotating cast of villains and they all have their own dungeons, but we'll get to that. And I'll let Corey go ahead and join in on the next one.
Yeah. So after this, Sojiro takes Joker to school, and then that's where you meet a new round of characters. One being Principal Kobayakawa. Your teacher, one of your teachers, Kawakami, the gym coach, Kamoshida, and they basically like lay down the law, if you will, and tell you like, you know, you're basically a fugitive, you're on probation, you have to be, you know, on best behavior at all times, don't cause any trouble.
Put one toe out of line.
They give you the normal expected rundown.
The principal's just really fat, dude. and
yeah, and bald. Yeah,
he reminded me of the Kingpin in the classic like Spider-Man cartoons.
Yeah. So on your first day of school, we get to meet the first introduction for these characters on
and through the main characters.
Yeah, you kind of become the trifecta, if you will, with On and Ryuji. They kind of, you know, they don't judge Joker. They seem to be more of the kind of cool, laid back, non-judgmental kind of people. They kind of just hit it off. And then Ryuji actually shows you around the school. And then while you're going around the school, Joker notices on his phone that this weird, like, app has popped up that he knows nothing about. And then what this app does, they learn, leads them to the metaverse that Igor and Justine and Caroline had told Joker about. And it leads into Kamoshida's palace, who is the reminder is the gym coach.
You get this impression pretty early on after meeting Kamoshida that he's like kind of a womanizer and maybe even like a sex, like, he's a pervert, and
he is a pervert,
and he hits on like all the girls, which who are underage.
Well, I think On actually just comes out and says that he's basically a womanizer.
Yeah. And On is this model. She's very pretty. She's got these huge ponytails, but she's nice, like very down to earth as well. And I don't think actually put this in here, but Ryuji is also like kind of on the outs at the school.
Yeah, something about you learn something about something went down with the track team, and that's all we kind of know. But we know that
he broke his leg and had to quit the track team. And I don't think this is in here, so I'll go ahead and say it. You find out later that Kamoshida basically planned it to where he would like trip and break his leg somehow.
Oh yeah, that's right.
So yeah, continue.
All right, so now we're in the palace, and this is where we meet Shadow Kamoshida. So in the palaces, this metaverse is supposed to be like alternate reality, almost like the true, quote unquote, true version
and
of
it's
events.
It's the school, but as a castle. So Kamoshida like sees the school as his castle.
As his castle, yeah. And so, and while he's there, we notice he's basically treated like a king. Everybody bows down to him, so on and so forth. But this castle is now full of monsters that we have to, you know, you get into battles with them and whatnot. And then there's a scene where Kamoshida tries to have our group executed. But then Joker, you get this really cool like cutscene where he awakens to his persona, who is Arsene? Arsene, yeah.
And during these scenes, they meet, whenever somebody awakens to their persona, they like rip their mask off and it like their face is all bloody. It's like a really cool effect.
Yeah, it leaves a blood imprint and their eyes get real big and then here comes their persona. But then once their persona awakens, they get their mask back because all these personas are kept in masks that you wear. But after we get our persona, our scene, we meet Morgana, who agrees to help us escape because Morgana's like locked in a cell as well. We've escaped the execution.
And he's like this 2 foot tall, like cat humanoid.
He's not a cat.
I'm not a cat.
So he's locked up and he tells us that if we get him out of his jail cell, that he'll help us escape. So we do our thing. We get Morgana out. He joins the team. And he teaches us all about the metaverse, palaces, personas, shadows, basically everything. Morgana is the information dump, if you will, and just basically catches you up. And then he actually, when you leave the metaverse and come back to the, quote, real reality, he's actually a cat that lives with
us now. Like an actual cat. And the way it works is if you've heard him speak in the metaverse, you can understand him in the real world. Even as a cat.
Right. So at this point you've left the metaverse and went back, but that's kind of like how the game is set up. You go in, you come out, you go in, you come out, you go in, come out. So it's not like when you go to a palace, you're stuck.
Unless you're Plow and you're usually going to have to return to each palace several times. And I will say at first I was annoyed by Morgana because it seems like these Japanese games always have to have like some kind of little cute mascot character. But the way they did it is like, he's actually like really important to the plot. So,
yep.
So over the next few days, Joker sort of adjusts to his school life, and they return to Kamoshida's palace a couple times. At one point, Ryuji obtains a persona as well. He's like accompanying Joker, and Morgana's calling him an idiot all the time. But I think they were like, they had Ryuji pinned to a wall or something during his awakening. I can't remember the exact details.
Yeah, I don't remember. Or was it when Kamoshida was like verbally abusing
maybe
him? And yeah, because the track team held him up against the wall and Kamoshida walked over and basically started insulting
and
him.
Ryuji was apparently the reason Kamoshida targeted him in the first place is he was like the only one on the track team that would like stand up to Kamoshida. And he went too far once, apparently. So Morgana explains that what they need to do is basically steal the heart of the palace owner. And not everybody has a palace, apparently. Apparently, it's only like people whose desires become like super corrupt or something like that. But in order to cause a real world change of heart, aka like they want to make Kamoshida like confess to his actions and, you know, be it not a total shithead, they have to find the treasure within the palace owners, the treasure within the palace. And so, but that also risks a mental shutdown, which is basically just like your brain dies.
Yeah. Well, you basically like become like a zombie, if you will, and you commit some horrible act.
So things become urgent when they learn that Kamoshida has been physically abusing all the male students and sexually abusing the female, like blackmailing them and stuff. Because I think, so on her best friend's name is Shido, and she's on the girls' volleyball team. And did I say Shido or Shiho? It's Shiho.
Shiho. You said Shido, but I think her name is
actually Shido. Shido was somebody else. But he's like blackmailing on to like try and get with him. And he says like he'll continue to like treat Shiho worse and worse if she doesn't comply. Like Shiho starts coming back from practice with like big bruises and stuff.
Yep.
So, and then in particular, there's one guy on the male volleyball team, I think, named Mishima, who's another student that you get to know pretty well through the game. But he's recruited Mishima to spread rumors and in order for them to like nobody like suspects Kamoshida of what he's really doing, or else he's just going to keep beating the shit out of Mishima.
Yep.
And then, like we said, Ryuji also lost his track team spot due to Kamoshida. So Kamoshida at this point, you're learning, is like, this guy is like a real like piece of shit.
He's a dick.
So one day on, she suspects that something's going on with Joker and Ryuji. So she follows them and is accidentally drawn into the metaverse with them at one point. This happens after Shiho attempts suicide because she can't take Kamoshida's abuse anymore. And she ends up...
She jumped off the roof of the school, like into the plaza where everybody was.
So An's like out for revenge at this point, obviously. And unless it happens at the end of An's confidant arc, Shiho never recovers. So they talk about how she might be getting better at one point, I think.
Yeah, An keeps hinting that she's making progress. But, you know, like you said, we'd probably have to get to the end of her confidant rank, which I will when I do New Game Plus. And we'll figure out what happens. But as far as we know, she's still in the hospital, just making very slow progress.
So at this point, the group is like, fuck Kamoshida. We're going to change his heart. And they make it official. And they become the Phantom Thieves of Hearts, which is awesome. You get to name the group in, if you want to. We named ours the Insiders. And it shows in the dialogue boxes, but they always just say the Phantom Thieves in the vocalization. Right. So it doesn't really matter. And they all adopt code names. So Joker is Joker, obviously. Ryuji is Skull because of his skull-shaped mask. And An is Panther. Because she has this, like, really, like, I'm sorry to say slutty, like, red leather suit with, like, a devil tail and cat ears.
I wouldn't say slutty. It's risque.
It's very risque. Because she looks awesome. Tight. Like, I'm not trying to take away from her as a character or anything.
Yeah.
And
it's very very much Britney Spears.
Oops, oh, yeah. I did it again, that's totally what it is. And Morgana is Mona, which I don't really get where that comes from.
I don't remember. Actually, I think Morgana just said his name's Mona, or he'll go by Mona. But I don't remember if they actually gave a reason for that.
So they attempt to, and then there's a scene later on where Ryuji and Joker sort of catch Kamoshida about to like beat the shit out of Mishima, and they sort of defend Mishima. And at this point, the school's like, okay, on this date, you three are going to be expelled from the school.
Yeah, Kamoshida threatens, like, you know, I'll make this happen.
And so that introduces, like, sort of the deadline system. All the palace owners in this game, a deadline comes up where you have to finish the palace by X date for some reason. So that's this one. And we should have said the game works on a calendar system. Like, you actually go day to day by day on the calendar, and different things happen each day and so forth.
Yep. So since the Phantom Thieves are beginning to form, the protagonist gets more acquainted with some other characters, including Kasumi Yoshizawa. She's also a new first-year student in Shujin. She's a talented gymnast, and because she's a freshman, she kind of gets along with Joker as well. We meet Takuto Maruki, a school counselor hired to help the students after Kamoshida turned himself into the police.
I guess that's actually a little later, but...
Yeah, it is, because we've not quite got there yet. But we do meet Takuto eventually. And then during our first exploration of Mementos, this is kind of like the... I think Morgana explains it as the cognitive world of society. So it kind of belongs to everybody.
It's like everyone else's palace that doesn't have their own palace.
Right. So this is where you end up going. It's big, looks like an underground, basically like an underground subway. We meet a mysterious entity in the form of a boy known as Jose. Aside from giving vital services in Mementos, he also grants the protagonist a wishing star capable of letting party members perform what is called showtimes, which is like a really cool tag team move that you can use in battle.
By the way, Jose, he wasn't in the original version either at all. So, yeah.
Oh, really?
And Morgana turns into a van, or you ride around in Mementos in.
Yeah, because it's like there's that scene where Ryuji's like, I don't want to go or walk all the way this way, and Morgana's like, let me show you something, and then turns into a van. He's like, are we supposed to just get in?
By the way, Morgana and Ryuji don't really get along, and it's always hilarious when they're arguing.
Shut up, cat. Right. I'm not a cat. So that was your like first introduction into Mementos. You will end up going there. Well, you don't have to go there a lot, but I ended up going there a lot just because it's a really good source of powering up. You can get items. You can get into a lot of battles. You can catch new personas, all kinds of stuff. So after this, we eventually locate Kamoshida's treasure. We've gone back into the palace now. Like we said, you can go in and out. You go into the palace. You find the treasure. And then when you find the treasure, Morgana always instructs you to, you know, hey, we found it. We know where the treasure is because so basically your first stage is complete. You have to find your route to the treasure. So he always says you've got to plan your route. So once you find your treasure, though, the game actually stops you from advancing, because then you have to do what is called sending a calling card. And sending the calling card kind of changes, I won't say changes gameplay, but it kind of, it changes your interactions in the real world. And then it kind of makes the person aware that you're coming for them. So their treasure kind of manifests so you can steal it. So we've got the treasure. We've sent the calling card. Kamoshida knows that we're coming. And you go in. You get into a big fight with him, which is epic. I still remember that fight because he's over to the left and you got to kind of walk over to him. And you do a really cool fight. And then once you beat him and take his treasure, you know, you have to wait for we said there's a deadline. You have to wait till that deadline day, and just basically the Phantom Thieves kind of cross their fingers and hope that they were successful when they stole the treasure. And sure enough, on the deadline, Kamoshida actually turns himself in. He admits guilt at a big school assembly. You know, everybody is taken aback and, oh God, I can't believe he could do this. And So he turns himself, basically turns himself in, admits what he's been doing, obviously gets arrested. And then that's when we meet, what was his name?
Maruki.
Is right at the
end. Real quick, that fight. I remember he's like this giant, like fat blob monster. He has like a wine glass in one hand and such, like very like a lolling tongue. And you have to like send somebody over to like drop up on him from above or something from the balcony.
Yeah, you send Ryuji up onto this like banister.
Mm-hmm. And he also summons like shadow versions of An and Shiho and Mishima to like fight against you. It's a really cool fight. Like Corey was saying.
Yeah, it's awesome. Well, most of them are.
So like Corey said, Maruki comes in, the school hires him as a therapist, to sort of like, I guess for public appearances mostly, to like all those kids that were like mentally fucked up by Kamoshida. And Maruki specifically singles you guys out as people he wants to talk to, since you were so closely connected to the incident. You start getting scenes of like him doing like therapy sessions with each party member. And he seems like this really nice guy, and he wants everybody to have snacks.
Always wanting snacks.
So, like we already talked about Mementos, but around this time, Mishima in the real world figures out who the Phantom Thieves are, basically. And he sort of teams up with you guys. He creates this website called the Fan Site with a P at the start, you know, like Phantom. And he runs like polls on there, and there's like a message board, and basically he uses it to find targets for the Phantom Thieves, like other jackasses out there in the world that could use a good heart changing.
He's basically our IT guy.
And he gives you, and these targets are all like in Mementos. So you go there for these little side quest things he gives you.
Because if your corruption is not like super bad enough, you don't get a palace. Your shadow goat is still in Mementos where everybody else technically is.
I really liked Mishima as a character, but apparently a lot of people don't.
I liked Mishima. I didn't have any.
He's really nice, kind of meek, and he like sort of learns to grow stronger through his confidant arc with him if you stick with it. But
yeah, I mean, early on, I can see why people might be like, he's kind of just whiny.
He pisses his pants in one scene, which is unfortunate. But
poor guy.
But yeah, that's basically the end of the Kamoshida arc, and so we'll move on to the next little saga.
Yep. So now that you've kind of, you got your feet underneath you, you got your first palace taken care of, you've got a team going, you're in Mementos, and as a team, you discover a shadow who has his own problems with a former art mentor. He's a famous art mentor. He's like this famous artist in Japan. But he goes by the name, Ichiryusei Madarame.
Yeah, and they always just call him Madarame.
Yeah, it's always Madarame. They never bring up the first name. So we get involved in the real world when we are approached by a student from a different school, Yusuke Kitagawa, who wishes On to be a model for him. He wants to paint.
He sort of just like approaches you out of nowhere on the street. You would be the perfect subject.
Yeah, that's right. Or he was, wasn't he like getting into a car and he saw On and just like walked away. He was like, I need to paint you. So we eventually discover that Madarame has been plagiarizing his student's work for his own gain, but we can't really learn more from Yusuke due to his loyalty. Yusuke is like, he will not turn against Madarame because that's his mentor. He basically lives with
him. Sort of like his father figure almost.
Yeah. But we know that Madarame is up to no good.
And Yusuke is another one of the main characters. He's like this slender, like kind of effeminate guy. He's like offbeat, but also like kind of, he's pretty wise in a lot of other ways.
He's very quirky.
He's quirky, but very level-headed. I actually like him quite a bit. So they eventually do discover Madarame's palace, which turns out to be a museum in which his pupils are the works of art. So basically he just sees all of his pupils as like ways for him to get famous. So in order to get, at one point they reach a block. This happens a few times in a few of the different palaces where you have to do something in the real world to remove a barrier in the palace. So in order to get further in the palace, An agrees to model for Yusuke, while Morgana attempts to pick the lock that should unseal the door in the palace.
And On goes like wearing like 8 layers of clothing.
Because she thinks like Yusuke is like trying to be a perv on her, I think.
Well, because she doesn't know Yusuke enough to trust him yet. And she's like, doesn't want to do the nude modeling, but he kind of wants to.
This scene is hilarious because like Joker and Ryuji come along too to like sort of be her buffer. And
to quote watch. Yeah,
it's like turns into a whole fiasco. So.
That whole segment's funny.
Yeah. And so Morgana does get the door open and they go in. And I think there's a bunch of like the pupil's art that's stolen, maybe even the Sayuri, which is a.
Yeah, because it was like the upstairs, basically where he stashed all the art.
And so the Sayuri was like by Yusuke's mother, who was like another like really good artist, apparently. And so he like really treasures that.
Yeah.
And basically at this point, Yusuke learns the truth about Madarame and begins to like sort of turn against him. But Madarame catches them in the room, and I think he, what does he actually throw Yusuke out?
Yeah. Tells him, you know, you're ungrateful, I've taken care of you, I've done this and that for you. Basically, you're on your own now.
So they go back to the palace, they get past the barrier, and Yusuke is actually able to go to the metaverse with them. And he awakens to his persona after he learns that Madarame actually played a role in his mother's death. And I can't remember what exactly Madarame did to his mother, like how he set up the death or whatever. Do you?
I don't remember either. But
anyway, he contributed to it. So Yusuke fully turns against Madarame and awakens to his persona, becomes a phantom thief, and his codename is Fox.
Yep. Oh, Fox. What is Futaba?
Stupid Inari. We'll get to that.
Yeah. All right. So now basically you've got Yusuke in your party. He's full-fledged phantom thief. So we eventually do kind of the same thing that you do in all the palaces. You make your route to the treasure. You leave. You send the calling card. You go back in. And that's when you get into the battle with Madarame's shadow. The real Madarame, after you defeat him, when you come back to the real world and hit your deadline, the real Madarame publicly apologizes for his plagiarism. Yusuke officially joins the Phantom Thieves because he wants to work on his own art style. He's always wanting to improve. And then he gives the famous painting of the Sayuri, which is, again, his mother's, to Sojiro to hang in Cafe LeBlanc. And it's actually really kind of touching because Sojiro like really likes the painting, loves it, and hangs it like right at the front door just so it can always
also
be seen.
Like at this point Yusuke's been hanging out with them for a little bit, and like Sojiro knows like he's broke and he's like always giving him food and shit. So
yeah, he's basically feeding Yusuke.
By this time Sojiro's kind of softened on Joker and like lets the friends hang out at the cafe when they want and stuff like that.
Yeah, and there's been several scenes where you can tell they're wanting you to like Sojiro because he's giving Yusuke food all the time and making fun of Ryuji, letting Morgana stay with him, stuff like that.
I don't really remember the Madarame fight that well. I seem to remember he had like marionettes or something that fought with him.
Yeah, yeah, there was like 4 of them, I think, because he said his students were puppets.
Oh, yeah. So that was one of the more forgettable boss fights for me, but...
Yeah, I don't remember much about that one either. But during this time, a teen celebrity detective by the name of Goro Akechi is on TV because the cafe has a TV that that boss, well, I call him boss, Sojiro, because Ryuji always calls him boss. He's always got the TV on. And so Akechi on television denounces the Phantom Thieves as criminals who are tampering with people's hearts.
Right. And I can't remember when this happens, but at some point there is a like a field trip to the TV studio where Akechi is doing an interview live on some kind of talk show.
I think it happens after this next one we're going to talk about.
I just wanted to make sure I didn't miss the whole like beginning of the Akechi arc.
No. First time we see him is on the TV, and then I think we do this next palace, and then we go to the TV station.
So then that's the end of that saga. So we've also been introduced to another character a little earlier than this, I think. Her name is Makoto Najima, and she is actually Sai's younger sister, Sai being the prosecutor that's been interrogating Joker in like the frame story. And she's the student council president, But around this time, she starts getting pressured by Principal Kobayakawa to find out the identities of the Phantom Thieves, because there's like a lot of pressure on the school at this point, because it's suspected that the Phantom Thieves, at least some of them, are students at the school. And I think Makoto doesn't really want anything to do with it, because she doesn't necessarily think what the Phantom Thieves are doing is wrong. But yeah. She catches on to it pretty quick, you know, that Joker and all them are the Phantom Thieves. She starts like being like a thorn in your side, showing up and like threatening you and stuff like that, kind of alluding to she thinks you're the thieves.
Well, she's like the student council president, so she's got a lot of power within the school.
They used to use the roof of the school as their like meeting place, and she like basically closes the roof down.
And she would keep barging in every time you'd have a meeting up there. She'd always show up.
So she's kind of like an antagonist at this point, a minor antagonist anyway. But I already liked her at this point, because she's like smart and like knew what she was doing, more or less.
Yeah. And she's very socially savvy. Yep.
However, eventually, believing in the Phantom Thieves cause, she promises not to out them after she figures out their identities for real, if they help her uncover a criminal ring taking advantage of students that has also been troubling her older sister, apparently. It's like a case that Sai's been looking into.
I like how on this doc you said her older sister, and then in parentheses you put Sai.
Yeah. So she's trying to like protect the students and whatever. And Kobayakawa keeps like, there's several scenes of him being like, why haven't you found them yet? And you could tell she's like trying really hard to lie to him.
Yeah, because, well, she's one of those, she actually has, like, the best intentions.
He threatens her, too, with something, like, he
was going to expel her.
Yeah, and he was like, that would, like, ruin the career of your sister, too, or something like that, if that were to happen.
Yeah. Or that, or he wasn't going to recommend her for
college. Oh, that's what it was, yeah,
like
he
that.
Wouldn't recommend
her. Yeah, yeah. So after this, we discover that the leader of this crime ring that Sai has been chasing is Junya Kaneshiro, but they're unable to take care of the problem.
They can't
themselves.
Figure out where his palace is or something like that, I think.
Yeah, they run into a problem. And then Makoto tries to meet with Kaneshiro directly, but Kaneshiro blackmails all of them for millions of yen. Somehow he finds out what they're up to, and then basically tells them, if you don't pay me millions of yen, he's going to out them. However, this helps them discover that Kaneshiro's palace is a floating bank covering Shibuya. I remember that scene. That was really cool.
Do you remember what Makoto's plan was for when she met up with Kaneshiro? I can't remember the details of what she was going to do and then like how it turned around.
I remember her going to meet up with him because he was at that like bar restaurant, whatever, sitting at that round table with like three women.
Yeah.
But I don't remember what she was actually going to do. Something. I know she brought up Sai, and she said she's my sister and we'll come after you or something. I remember the scene, but I don't remember the reasoning.
I was like, damn
it.
Girl, that's bold. And even though she acts like super confident, her self-esteem actually isn't that high. So she feels
it's not because she's always like nervous.
She feels like really dejected at this point because she failed basically.
Yeah.
So Makoto ends up getting wrapped up into the palace thing too. She goes to the metaverse with him, and she has her own, you know, she runs into Shadow Kaneshiro, who looks like a fly. He has like fly eyes.
But he's a fly like in a white suit.
he sort of like taunts her, and you know, through her own perceived ineptitude, she like sort of realizes she has to change. And this is when she awakens to her persona. I believe it was called Johanna.
Johanna. This scene was really cool because even like in the back where Yuji's like, guys,
yeah.
Because she like basically explodes, and then that's when Johanna, who is like a motorcycle, like zooms into the palace and takes out the two goons that Kaneshiro had.
Yeah, she
them.
Can ride her persona like a motorcycle, and she gets like this leather studded outfit. She looks like a biker almost. She looks really cool, I think.
Yeah, it's all black. She's got the mask is actually like a V-shaped piece of metal, which is really cool.
So she becomes like the Phantom Thieves strategist, and her code name is Queen. Yas Queen.
she's McQueen.
Not a whole lot more interesting happens in this part. You steal kind of Shiro's treasure, and then you have the fight with him. What do you remember about the boss fight?
Let's see. I'm trying to remember. Because he is like a fly. Mm-hmm. And then
I think he throws a lot of like goons at you.
I'm wanting to say you're right because, oh wait. Also, he does the, he's the one that goes up like into the ball, ball. Yeah. That's the one he does because you fight some of his goons and then he goes up in that metal ball.
He goes like full Eggman. It's like and gets in a mech.
Well, it's the bank vault. Oh yeah. Remember? Cause he goes into the bank vault and then the vault like pops out of the wall.
Yeah. So,
I mean, it wasn't like a particularly interesting battle, but it was that was more like cutscene heavy. Yep. Not cutscene heavy, but like more stylish, I guess, with the bank vault and all that.
Right. So they decide to, they steal the treasure. Kaneshiro confesses and it leads to his arrest. And Makoto decides she's going to stick with the Phantom Thieves.
Yep. So they solved one of Sai's cases. So after this, we're kind of leading into summer vacation because, you know, again, this follows a calendar system. So we're now into the summer months. So school's going to be letting out. But we keep getting taunted by a hacker who goes by the name Medjet. That's all we know about him.
It's like a hacker then, dark web collective. They've decided they're going to go against the Phantom Thieves to like raise their clout, I guess. Think Anonymous.
Yeah. And think Anonymous. But then another mysterious hacker that all we know as Alibaba says they will get rid of Medjet if the Phantom Thieves steal their own heart. So they're asking the Phantom Thieves, steal my heart and I'll take care of it. So we figure out that Alibaba is actually Futaba Sakura. And you might recognize that last name because it is Sojiro's secret adopted daughter. She's a shut-in. After the death of her mother, who was a cognitive scientist by the name of Wakaba. So we've learned now that Sojiro actually has a kid living with him who we didn't know about because she refuses to leave her room.
Right. She looks like an inkling from Splatoon with her hair.
Yeah, she really does.
There's this scene where they break into Sojiro's house because they figured out that's where she lives. And,
oh yeah, that's right.
She won't come out of her room, and they like keep trying to talk her out of it. And Sojiro catches them and is like, "What the fuck?"
Yeah, because An is like trying to like sweet talk her through the door, like, "We won't be mean to you. We want to be your friend. We just want to meet you." And like she'll talk to him through the door, but she will not open the door.
So and also, when we say cognitive scientist, it's scientist with a P at the beginning, like Psy.
Yeah.
And so she actually, there's like this whole like secret branch of science where they study the metaverse and like people's cognition and stuff like that. So they make it to Futaba's palace, which is like a giant pyramid, and it's a tomb that she apparently feels trapped in. And she believes that if her heart is stolen, she will be freed of her suicidal thoughts and guilt because she thinks that she's responsible for her mother's death. I think it was like her mother pushed her out of the way from a car or something.
Yeah, she got hit by a car saving Futaba.
But didn't it turn out later that it was actually like somebody else that did it or something? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, she didn't. It didn't work the way Futaba thought it did.
Oh, yeah. She had like created like her own version of what happened that wasn't true.
Yeah. So Futaba is eventually able to enter her own palace. When she's confronted with Shadow Futaba, she's faced with her cognitive view of Wakaba, who is now a monstrous beast.
It's like a giant sphinx with the head of like a woman in glasses. It's really freaky, but also pretty cool, I thought.
Yeah. And after, if I'm not mistaken, though, before we go into this battle, didn't we also learn, like, as you go through the tomb, you learn more and more about Wakaba? But I remember the Shadow Boss like keeps verbally abusing Futaba,
right?
And telling her, you know, you're the reason I'm dead. I should have never had you. You're a mistake.
Yeah. And there's like this, and at one point they figure out that Futaba can actually come into the palace with her own palace with them.
Yeah. And then, so once we get into this battle with the shadow version of Wakaba, we accept that Futaba accepts that she's not responsible for her death. And when she finally truly accepts that she's not at fault, this is when she awakens to her persona. And this is like right in the middle of battle that she does this. And then with the help of Futaba's new persona, we are able to defeat Wakaba and change Futaba's heart without stealing treasure. We just had to basically awaken her to her right. persona.
Which is like this big UFO thing that like its tentacles yeah. come down and bring her inside it, which was like, I've seen enough hentai, I know where this is going.
But, oh God!
So she in battle is able to like you don't directly control her, but she'll like give you buffs and debuffs and stuff all the time, just randomly.
Yep.
So that's basically the end of that arc. Around here, I think is when they try to start having Futaba like get used to being around people. Like they each take turns like hanging out with her and stuff.
They do, and then like she wants to go to some computer store to buy a new computer, and she's like, she asked you as like Joker, like, just come with me, and then turns out she like had us a full-on like panic attack.
Yeah, it's kind of sad, but she does start coming around eventually.
Oh yeah, she gets much
and,
better.
And one in particular, I can't remember what exactly happened, but when it was like Yusuke's turn to hang out with Futaba, they don't necessarily get along right away, and I can't remember yeah. the details, but like she starts calling him Stupid Inari, and she called
Stupid
which
Inari,
which I guess is probably like some kind of fox thing in Japanese, but yes. It's really funny every time she does it.
It becomes like a relationship, like a Ryuji and Morgana. Yeah.
And I don't think I actually did write down about the TV studio thing. So there is a field trip where they go to the TV studio during Akechi's live interview. And afterwards, Akechi, like, apparently the group caught his eye in the crowd, and he, like, introduces himself to him, and he starts becoming, like, cordial with Joker, and he becomes, like, a confidant and stuff, and Joker hangs out with him and stuff, and you start to, like, slowly build this trust with him, even though you're, like, gotta keep him at arm's length, because he could figure out, you know, who we are.
Yeah, because he's also a confidant, so you want to build your rank up.
By the way, I learned that apparently in the original version, he was a confidant, but all his rank ups happened automatically. So there wasn't like
really?
All those scenes that they have in this game.
Huh, well, shit.
But that's basically the end of that arc. So jumping into the next one here, which is going to be like the last arc we cover today, I think. So,
well, we have been going for a while.
Actually, we're doing pretty good on time.
Good.
So the team's like basking in their defeat of Medjed, which there was like some kind of twist where Medjed was like not even real. Oh, I think it turned. We'll talk about that more later. But it's yeah. time for a school trip to Hawaii. It's the beach arc that every anime has. So Mishima implements a poll on the fan site asking for a new target with the idea that whoever is voted the highest will be like who the thieves go after next. And meanwhile, they all go to Hawaii. All the kids do. And I can't remember how, but like even Yusuke and Futaba end up being able to come along too, even though they're not students.
Well, I think all the schools went to Hawaii that year because there was Yusuke explained like something happened and they were supposed to go somewhere else, but that trip had to get canceled. So that school like joined Shuden.
But how the hell did Futaba get there? Because she's not a student anywhere.
Yeah, good question on Futaba. That one, I actually don't remember.
I feel
that
like
one.
She just shows up, like she's stowed away or something. But
she probably did.
But Morgana is left behind, and Morgana is like kind of being a little bitch about that. He feels like left out of the team, and he starts like questioning his role in the group.
That was Morgana's most annoying, like
yeah.
arc.
So they go to the beach, you know, they have like all these beach scenes. Futaba like learns to, you know, be around other people. The boys like cruise the beach trying to find girls and
Ryuji freaks out at An's bikini. Yeah.
We'll talk about that later, but there's a lot of like the boys are pretty horny for the girls like the whole game, especially in the animated cutscenes.
Yeah.
Bonk. Yeah, for real. Horny Jill.
Horny Jill.
So shortly after they return, I don't think anything else of significance really happens at Hawaii, right?
The Hawaii thing is like little to no gameplay. It's all just a story arc.
So shortly after they return from Hawaii, there's like a big twist. Principal Kobayakawa, he has basically decided he's going to come clean, I think. Like, he can't hide the truth anymore about the school. And so he's like on his way to the school, and he all of a sudden suffers a mental shutdown, and then it is hit by a truck because it happens in the middle of a street.
Yep.
Actually, I did put here that he was on the way to the police station to report his involvement in the conspiracy. Yeah. So that sort of like sends a shockwave through the school. Everybody's like shook. And then public faith in the Phantom Thieves begins to waver because it's like, oh, well, they killed. Everybody's blaming the Phantom Thieves for the mental shutdown. Even though we learn later that that is not the case.
We were in Hawaii.
Yeah. But life goes on. The winner of the poll is... Oh, were you shocked by the Kobayakawa death?
Absolutely. Yeah, I was like, holy shit, because at this point he had been like, I won't say a main character, but he was definitely a key story.
I was sort of expecting him to have a palace later.
I was too. That's why I was like, holy shit, they actually just offed him.
But the winner of the fan site poll is Kunikazu Okumura, who is the owner of a successful fast food chain called Big Bang Burger, which
Big Bang
which Corey
Burger.
Ate at all the time, especially early in the game.
Yep.
They sort of debate, the Phantom Thieves debate, like whether they should just do what the public says. But an argument breaks out between Morgana and the rest of the group. I think Ryuji and him like really get into it.
Yeah, it was a knockdown, drag out fight.
So Morgana's identity crisis about who he is, because he's not even, I think he's not even, or starting to think that maybe he was never human at this point.
Yeah, because up to this point, he always thinks he's a human that needs to do something to change back to a human.
And it ultimately leads to him like leaving the group in order to prove himself, which is very dramatic.
Yep. Stakes
and
out on his own.
Kind of worried about him, but they can't find him. So.
Yep. And then at this point, we find Okumura's palace, which is basically a space station sweatshop. Because the reason it's a sweatshop is he views all of his workers as basically replaceable robots. They're there just to do a job and nothing else. So, and he, you know, is not the best company out there with it. It really heavily plays into workers' rights and stuff like that. Yeah. So they decide to go through with the infiltration. But then we run into Morgana, who has found and taken in a new Persona user that we've not met. We discover that she is Haru, who is Okumura's daughter.
This is interesting because we've never met like somebody else who is already a Persona user.
Yeah, like she already has her power and everything. But she wants to change her father's heart to end the mistreatment of all the employees. She's also spurred by her father's attempted arranged marriage to Sugimura. She doesn't like the guy. She
doesn't
get along with the guy. We find out later that he's probably abusive. So the only reason this marriage was set up, though, is because he is actually the son of a very well-known and very influential politician. So that's why Okumura wants Haru to
and he won't hear anything about anything otherwise, basically. He sees Haru as like the heiress to the fortune, and like she's just another tool for him to use to elevate himself.
Yep, she's just there to take over when he's done. Eventually, the ill feelings between the team and Morgana get mended after Haru is forced to confront her abusive fiancé. Haru finally stands up to him with the help of the team. Haru also helps Morgana overcome his fears of who he actually is. There's a lot of dialogue there where they basically go to therapy.
She basically has like her own, like her awakening scene, even though she already has one. Like her persona gets powered up when they face Sugimura, but like the Okumura's cognitive version of her fiance.
Of her. Yeah, of him. And that's when she, because she's got a persona, but then it changes. I forget its new name too.
Oh, I don't remember.
But it It's the big it's the woman with the big gigantic right. dress where the front lowers and guns yeah. come out. All right, so why don't you go ahead and lead us on?
I thought it was your turn.
You're blue.
So on October 3rd, the this is the reason I'm specifying a date is because it's like a part of a totally separate plot. But the protagonist Morgana and Kasumi find themselves in an unknown palace linked to the construction site of a stadium in Odaiba. And Kasumi doesn't have any idea, like, you know, what the metaverse is and all that. She's just like this really sweet gymnast girl who's friends with Joker. She calls him Senpai. But there, Kasumi finds a cognitive version of her deceased sister, who is quickly squashed by a tall, lanky, like disturbing shadow that bursts in. So Kasumi's frustration at the school administration, they're like pushing all their desires onto her, expecting her to get first place no matter what. Along with her grief of the death of her younger sister, she awakens to her persona here, Syndrillion. And so she teams up with Joker and Morgana to defeat the shadows. After they escape, Morgana invites Kasumi to join the Phantom Thieves, but she declines because she feels like she's not sure her ideals actually align with what the Phantom Thieves are doing. And she wouldn't want to join without being fully invested. But we got another Persona user out there somewhere.
Yeah, I was actually almost disappointed in this because I wanted her to join up, and because Syndrillion was a cool persona.
Yeah,
too.
I feel like it wouldn't have been that hard to write it that way to where she did join from here on. But
yeah,
oh well.
But maybe they just wanted to lead you on and make you think, you know, hey, you don't get every persona
right,
user.
Right.
Yeah. So after this, we finally managed to steal Okumura's treasure. We leave, send the calling card, come back, all that.
You get the hardest boss in the game.
Oh, yeah. And when we get to gameplay, I've got something to say about this one.
He basically sends like successive waves of progressively harder robots to represent his workers at you.
Oh, it's making blood pressure rise just thinking about it. So so while the Phantom Thieves celebrate their victory at basically Tokyo Destiny Land, which is obviously supposed to be Disneyland, they watch in horror as Okumura dies on live television from a mental shutdown.
He was in the middle of his confession. And they're watching.
Yep, and because we're like on a rooftop eating as a group, and across like this plaza is this big screen TV that he's basically confessing on. And at this point, when he actually dies on live television, the public just about loses all faith in the Phantom
Thieves. Your popularity rating on the fan site plummets to like zero, basically.
Yeah, it plummets completely.
Because now there's like two deaths that people believe were committed by the Phantom Thieves.
Yep.
Somebody.
And I think somebody in the group actually wonders if they were responsible because he died right after, you know, after changing it or. Yeah, stealing his heart and changing it. I think somebody in the group actually wonders if they're mm-hmm. responsible. I can't remember if it was Haru or Ryuji, or it might have been On, actually. I think it was On.
One of the villains at some point tells you that there is another Persona user out there that's like going around and targeting people that's responsible for the mental shutdown.
That was Kaneshiro.
Yeah.
He says there's a what does he call it? The black shadow or something.
Yeah. So we'll learn more about that later, much later.
Yeah.
But I think that's going to be where we're going to cut off the story. There's still a few palace owners left, but the plot really starts getting not convoluted, but very like detailed after this.
It really picks up because, I mean, it's been a very thick plot already, but after this, it kicks into high
right.
gear. So we do want some extra time to talk to you all about all yeah. those. Fun little
hopefully
details.
We'll be able to get through it in one episode.
Fingers crossed.
So around this point in the story, like generally, how are you feeling about the plot?
You know, I was by this time I was already really drawn into the game. I was enjoying it because actually this part is when I started enjoying the game again, because I enjoyed the game all the way up to Shadow Okumura. And then you remember that boss fight I tried. I don't know how many times, couldn't beat it, and actually set the game down and probably didn't play it for what, two,
something
3 weeks?
Like that.
And then one day, just I was like, let's give it a shot. And after, oh God, probably 6 hours of trying and beating it, and then seeing him actually like die during the mental shutdown on TV just brought me right back.
You're like, oh shit.
But up until I fully enjoyed the story up till now.
It's really good.
Just minus that one stupid boss fight.
We are actually only covering the main story. Like, there's lots of other shit that we're not even talking about that happens.
There's loads and loads of details that, I mean, you just can't talk about all of it. It's a big ass game.
There's like 18 confidants that have like their own side story. Not that they're.
Oh yeah, you have side stories with just about every confidant, and I mean, there's a lot baked in. So like Scott said, we're just trying to a very general overview of the main
story.
Even
their main character, the main characters have their own like side plots that are going on that we're probably not going to cover. So, if we find time, we're going to try to cut out a section of maybe like the next episode or the one after to talk about like maybe what our favorite side plots were and stuff like that. But we'll see.
So I know you didn't actually play the game, but what did you think of the story up till now?
I was really drawn in. The only thing, there are some lulls, and I think that's partially due to the calendar system, where you can go a week without any like huge plot development while you wait for like the deadline, especially after if you defeat the palace boss, and then you still have like a week and a half before the deadline.
That's what I was just about to say.
So I think it's really good, and like, you know, it was fun to watch, and I was like invested in the characters. I liken it to like an anime version, an high school anime version of Ocean's 11. You have this one side of your life where you're a normal person, but then you also have this side of your life where you're like a group of total badasses, and you feel, even me not playing, I was like, yes, this is awesome. And I was just like there was lots of parts where I was like glued to the screen, like, what's going to happen next? So I really enjoyed it too so far. And it only gets better from here, really, I think.
It does.
But anything else you want to say about the story before we close this thing out?
Up till now, I think we've done a pretty good job of covering it. We're as best we can.
Let's move on to the outro. Let's wrap up here. Corey?
So Lauren in the chat said high school anime Ocean's 11 sounds amazing.
Hi, Larly. Yeah, it is amazing. So what are we going to be talking about next week, Corey?
So next week, you will get a break from the Persona talk. We, as Scott's told you in the past, we have to break this thing up into multiple pieces. So next week will be a topic of favorite and least favorite mechanics of an RPG game.
This was Jay's idea. I'm not sure if we've even, I think this might have been a topic before, but in particular, we really want to talk about stealing. I'm not sure why I signed that to you, because you're not going to be on the episode, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm not, I won't be there.
So another reason we have to break this up is because of RPG Club. We don't want to have to do RPG Club segments on a review episode. So it works out perfectly that we do episodes between the review segments. But just as a reminder, once again, you have until September 20th to finish Pandemonium in Wild Arms. And by the time this episode comes out to the public, you'll only have a couple days left. So get to it.
Start playing.
And for our plugs, if you like the show and wish to help us out, one of the best ways to do that is to go onto your Podcatcher app and rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, whatever service you use. The way that algorithms work on these things, it's like, even if you give us a bad review, it like boosts the show kind of, because we got a review.
Bad reviews.
5 stars, please. But it elevates the show. It helps more people find it. So we would really appreciate you doing that. But perhaps an even better way for you to help out the show
is money. Money talks. So if you sign up for the Patreon and throw a few bucks at these guys once a month, you get a lot of stuff. Just a recap of what you get. You'll get early episode access. The episodes will drop on your feed a couple days early every week. You won't have to listen to Rich say the word anchor anymore, because you'll get ad-free episodes. You'll get the aftercast where they kind of cut loose on any topic they want, a little more relaxed conversation. You'll get extra reviews, and there is a shit ton of extra reviews already in the backlog and plenty more coming. You'll get to take part in the RPG club with nominations. You'll get the vote and much more. So go go over to patreon.com/RPGAfterYears and open your wallet.
Give us money. No,
we really appreciate money now, please.
All the support of our current patrons as well. And I can't remember if I said this. Go ahead.
You need that meme of from It's Always Sunny with Charlie's mom when she had cancer. Money me now, please.
Yes, I do. Did I say what the next aftercast is going to be about earlier?
No, I don't think so. We're actually
recording an aftercast tomorrow, and it's going to be about the relationship between fitness and gaming and like nerd culture and how it's so different from fitness. That should be interesting. Well, it'll be interesting to see how that goes, but we'll be on Twitch at 9 a.m. Sunday tomorrow, and that's our regular time slot. So you can find us on twitch.tv/RPGAfterYears, and we hope to see you all there.
And another way to reach out to these guys is email. If you've got some feedback for the show that you don't want to put in a review, or you got some ideas or anything you want to tell these guys, you can email them at rpgafteryears@gmail.com. But probably one of the more interactive ways to get in touch is join the Discord community. You can find the link to the Discord in the show notes or the pinned tweet that is on Twitter. And there's always a lot going on in that Discord. And so head over to Twitter, click the link. And speaking of Twitter, where can they find you at, Scott?
You can find the show at RPG Years, and you can find me at the Scott Spot.
And you can find me at VFL Corey with an E.
And I almost forgot. Don't forget that the merch store is now live on Redbubble. Just search RPG After Years. Get yourself a mug and a bunch of shirts.
Yeah, go get you a shirt.
It looks really good. I still need to wash mine, or I would be wearing one today. So
I was supposed to wash this one before I wore it, and I didn't.
I won't tell anybody.
Oops.
But yeah, we would really appreciate anybody that wants to rep the show. They're pretty nice. And that'll do it for this week's episode. We got to get off to the metaverse, and next week we'll have another session of the RPG Club. But until then, I'm Scott.
And I'm Corey.
We'll catch you guys next time for episode 33 of the RPG After Years. Bye.
Your rehabilitation is not complete.
Nice.